Good afternoon, good afternoon, good afternoon. It is a Thursday, almost the end of the week. Can you believe that? Thursday, August the 10th, 2017. Those lazy, hazy dog days of August here in the Midwest. Currently 12:12 p.m. Eastern Daylight Time. And we're going to have a great show today. Coming up next hour, just want to give you a heads up. We are going to have open phone lines to discuss all of the things going on in the world. I know we've had lots of requests to do open phone lines this week, so we are going to do that from 1:15 to 2 p.m. today, so stay tuned for that. But in our first hour, we're very lucky to be joined by one of my favorite guests. He has been on the show several times before, and it always is a pleasure to have him on to discuss what's going on in the world. He was an advisor, draft speech writer, and close friend of one of the greatest people of the 20th century, maybe one of the greatest people of all time, Martin Luther King Jr. He is Clarence Jones. Mr. Jones, how are you?
Hi, how are you, sir?
Always good to speak with you. Certainly, we don't have a boring moment when it comes to things going on in the world anymore.
That's the understatement. That is certainly true.
Well, just to kind of get right into it here, the big story that seemed to dominate this week, well, there were two. Let's start with the first one. President Trump makes some remarks to North Korea about fire and fury. North Korea says we might attack Guam. What do you make of that whole situation?
Well, I had, I believe, like most people, I was obviously concerned what appeared to be a ratcheting up of the rhetoric that was going on between the leader of North Korea and the president. And then on a more sobering reflection, I now live here in Palo Alto, just a few miles south of San Francisco, and I see these graphic charts showing the distance that a rocket would fly from North Korea to San Francisco to Guam, Chicago, and so forth. It's the understatement we're at a serious point. But rather than, I suppose, breaking with many of my friends who might otherwise support me, we're dealing with our survival here, and while I did not vote for Mr. Trump and I have opposed most of his policies, there is something to the necessity of sort of telling it like it is. And the best example I can use is that I've been reflecting in the last 24 hours. I say. Let's stand back. What would Israel do? What would the Mossad and Israel do if they received such a threat like this? We're talking about our survival. In fact, I jokingly said to someone that maybe what Trump should do is just contract our protection over to the Israelis, because they seem to have a sense of what to do when their survival is at stake. And I have great disagreements. Many disagreements with the Israeli domestic foreign policy relating to the Palestinians, et cetera, et cetera. But as a nation of descendants, all or most of whom were descendants of people who were incarcerated and killed in the Holocaust, when they say never again, they mean never again. And I don't know that we have. Maybe as I think one of the officials in the Trump administration said, characterizing what President Trump said, as he's saying in the language of the North Korean leader, language he understands that apparently has not been understood in the diplomatic language that we try to use. So I suppose if I'm forced to choose, do I support or not support President Trump on this issue dealing with the question of the survival of the United States, While I disagree with his language, I support his intent.
Where do you think this will go? Do you think a lot of people have suggested it could be the second time in the history of this nation that we might use a nuclear weapon? Or is it manpower? Where do you see this going if it does escalate?
Well, I cannot foresee. If I could, I suppose I'd be the most sought-after person in the world. I cannot foresee where it's going. I'm hoping that saner minds will prevail on the part of the North Korean leadership. It's clear that their reason for having nuclear weapons is tied into their belief that that's essential for their regime to survive. They looked at what happened in Iraq with Gaddafi, with Saddam Hussein, and in Libya where Gaddafi gave up his nuclear weapons, and clearly the reason as Israel has nuclear weapons is for its own survival. The reason Pakistan and India have nuclear weapons is for their mutual survival. So the North Koreans have said that they want to have this as a form of survival, believing which, and I'm trying to find out what rational basis they can believe they are threatened either by the United States or the South Korean regime. And then I say this as a non-combat veteran of the Korean War, the Korean War in 1950. I'm trying to figure out where do they perceive the threat coming from. The solution, I believe, lies with less confrontational diplomatic language, I believe lies with China. China was a major factor in the first Korean War, where General MacArthur, disobeying the orders of President Truman, and tried to advance up to the Yalu River between North Korea and China, and that provoked the entry of the Chinese People Army into North Korea and fighting directly with the American troops and turn the tide against American troops. And we suffered a lot of casualties as a result of that. So the bottom line is, for me, the solution doesn't lie in continued escalating rhetoric, but diplomatic negotiation with China. And I think that's the only rational approach I see. But again, I want to say that you know, what is the presidential leader supposed to say when somebody says they're going to take you out? And what are you supposed to say? You know, I mean, Trump had a gut reaction, which I think, contrary to the media and all the people who are coming down criticizing him, I think he reflects the gut reaction of a large segment of the American people, despite of the so-called anti-Trump polling. And just to remind those people listening to me, I am not pro-Trump. I did not vote for him. I didn't work for him. I'm just looking at it politically and clinically.
It's interesting because this morning there were some tweets sent out, and basically President Trump was comparing himself with President Obama in this matter, saying that President Obama basically let everybody know what he was going to do, and President Trump is playing it better than President Obama did. Do you think that President Trump has handled North Korea better than President Obama did?
No, I do not. In terms of how we got there, how we got here today from where we were from the end of Obama's term, no, I do not. I think that President Obama was a skilled, consummate, thoughtful, deliberate president. One might say there is criticism that his, quote, failure to be more, quote, aggressive may have invited these actions on the part of North Korea. I don't know that there is objective historical facts to support that. and nor that it matters in this new era where facts apparently no longer matter. There are real empirical facts, and then there are so-called other facts that are supposed to have some equivalent. Wait, so the answer to your question, no, I think it's a question of styles. But I would never say that Trump has handled North Korea better than President Obama. I do not agree with that.
The assumption of North Korea for a long time has been that they are a country that you do not want to have nuclear weapons because they have a leader who is not sane. Then something dawned on me this morning, and I wonder if people remember this. Back when George W. Bush was president, the same idea was thought of, that they're a dictatorship and he's kind of nutty over there. But the two reporters got locked up over there, and they wanted to see former President Bill Clinton. And Bill Clinton went over there after his term, during George W. Bush's term, met with the leaders. I believe it was Kim Jong-il still at that point, the father.
I think it was in connection, seeking to get someone's release, I think.
And he did obtain their release.
Right.
And brought them back. Now, that means, obviously, they do want to meet with certain American presidents. They do obviously negotiate.
Right.
How crazy can they be?
I agree with you.
So
my point is, yes. I mean, maybe they're crazy like a fox. I'm not sufficiently knowledgeable or encyclopedic about the detail of existing issues that currently comprise the dispute between North Korea, South Korea, and the United States. I just have a generic overview. But clearly, I thought that after Rex Tillerson, our Secretary of State, said that the United States is not seeking regime change, which apparently has been the rationale for the North Korean leaders to have nuclear weapons, is that is to protect them from the United States, who might seek to want to overthrow or change their regime. So having assurances to the extent that those assurances they can believe or rely on, that no, we're not seeking to change your regime, we're just seeking to negotiate a stalemate with respect to your use of nuclear weapons. So, maybe this is the North Korean form, as crazy as it might be, in having a temper tantrum, wanting to get the attention, the maximum attention of the United States, in hopes that, in fact, negotiations can be resumed. It doesn't, from an outsider, and I just not just from me, but just from the average person, I would think that that's a crazy form and way to do it. You don't want to, particularly with Donald Trump, since so much of his leadership as president is tied up in what I call ego leadership. It's like a super macho president. He doesn't want anybody to challenge his macho man Trump leadership.
Maybe this is a deeper question, but this being the anniversary of the week the only nuclear weapon was ever used, 70-some-odd years ago now, you are exactly right that countries want to obtain these weapons in some way for security, that this is the way we can stay safe. But why do you think, in 70 years, not just on us, because the thought, when we hear about it, it's always they're planning on dropping something our way.
Right.
But why has no other country that's obtained them ever dropped them on any other country? It's never happened in 70 years. Why do you think that is?
Well, I think that's because the denominator, a common international denominator among leaders of the nations that have nuclear weapons, that the use of those nuclear weapons might be the trigger that could set off events beyond the control of either contending parties. This is aside from the question of, quote, the morality, close quote, of using nuclear weapons. Those people listening should go and look at and refresh themselves, refresh their recollection about the speech that President Truman made to the Japanese people before dropping the first atomic bomb. And in describing it, he said it was going to be, I mean, these are not an exact quote, but in effect, he was using words which is an early version of Trump's words. It's going to be, a kind of mass destruction that the world has never seen before. That was Harry Truman saying that as a way of wanting to bring the Japanese leadership to their senses. There's no question. There is some question, but in my mind, as I look back over that history, Truman's decision to use the atomic weapons fundamentally transformed the Second World War and undoubtedly saved hundreds of thousands of casualties that would have taken place between the Japanese and the Americans in the Pacific. So, hindsight is better than foresight. But it was the use of overwhelming force to demonstrate to the Japanese leadership it was useless for them to pursue their war against the United States. So the answer, why hasn't anybody used it since? I think there is some institutional memory left about the consequences of the use of the first nuclear bomb. And the magnitude of the weapons we have today have been described as being greater by a multiple of X than the atomic bombs and dropped on Hiroshima and the hydrogen bombs tested thereafter.
When we look at history, this time in history, years from now, how do you think it's going to be reflected? I remember a lot of people asking that question during President Obama's presidency when people were making remarks that could be construed as racially motivated. How do you think in 50 years they're going to look back on the first 6 months of the eventful Trump presidency?
Well, I don't think there'd be one singular characterization. I think there'll be multiple characterizations. Among them will be the resurgence of American nationalism, the resurgence of what in earlier centuries have been called America First. Trump is running on has run and successfully got elected on a policy of domestic national exclusion. His policy of immigration is we welcome legal immigrants, but anybody who is here illegally, you got to go back. And we're going to use every effort we can to return you from where you came from. So I think we're going to look back at this time as an era of the resurgence of America First nationalism. That first and foremost, we are thinking about ourselves, and the rest of the world be damned. And to the extent that we have been an international supporter and participant in just causes to assist other nations, his attitude, charity begins at home. We don't have the resources. We can't do it. And it has struck a chord. It has struck a chord with a substantial segment of the American population. So, I happen to take the so-called polls with a grain of salt. Everybody's saying his presidency is collapsing, and so and so and so and so. I said, well, maybe yes, maybe no. I think that his election represented such a qualitatively transformational political event that it obviously requires the most thoughtful and knowledgeable political persons in the media, in government, etc., to just pause and reflect and say, there is something going on. I wish I was astute enough to be able to accurately define it, but I am astute enough to know that there's something going on. In other words, if you experience a situation where you have a ringing in the ears, you know that there's something wrong with your ears, that there's a ringing in the ears, okay? There's a ringing in the ears of the nation. Or to use another metaphor, there is a canary in the coal mine in the election of Donald Trump that is saying to a lot of those people who did not support him. And politically, I say that the country seems to have been divided between the West Coast and the East Coast, and there's a large portion of America in between. And I'm very suspect of these polls that tell us, polls by the media and so-called erudite politicians, his Trump's support for Dr. Trump, the support for Donald Trump, has collapsed. His support may be significantly lower than it was before. But my perception is that he has tapped into something very deep in this country that an overwhelming majority of people are responding to and have responded to. And by the way, if anybody tells you that all black people are against Dr. Trump, I keep Dr. Trump because of Dr. King on my mind. If all black people are against Donald Trump, they are crazy. Okay? All black people are not against Donald Trump. They may be against some of the things or the way he says it, but in terms of some of the things he's trying to do, there are a number of black people who support him. His rhetoric is what turns them off. But, as quiet as it's kept, and people are uncomfortable talking about it, one of the greatest community that has been most adversely affected, not only, but most adversely affected by illegal immigration, has been the African-American community. Now, somebody will say, well, that's not so because immigrants will take jobs and no African-American would take. I said, well, I've heard that line before. I repeat, the community most adversely affected by illegal immigration is the African-American community. Now, I know this is going to offend some of my Democratic friends, but it won't be the first time I offended Democratic friends.
Mm. You know, it's interesting. The other day, I heard former President Jimmy Carter speaking. And it wasn't even really a political speech. It was just about his belief in heaven and God. And they were asking, you know, why do certain things happen? And he was talking about one of his early races, political races, before he became president, and how he ran against Lester Maddox. And for people who don't remember that name...
Oh, I remember that very well.
Yes, absolutely. Most people would consider Lester Maddox a racist.
And, oh, absolutely.
Yeah. And Lester...
Carried a bat or a cane or something, a bat.
A horrible, horrible guy.
Horrible, yeah.
And
out stone-cold racial segregationist, no question about it.
And in the South, Jimmy Carter lost an election to him. And Jimmy Carter said to God, he said, that is one of the times he said in his life, to get to the punchline here, was he questioned his faith. Because why would God let that happen?
Happen, right.
Yeah. So I think a lot of Democrats, honestly, believe the same thing about Trump following Obama. Because it's almost like we went the exact other direction. And I'm not saying Donald Trump is a racist at all or anywhere near Lester Maddox, but I think a lot of people feel that sometimes things just happen, present themselves that are always there that we don't necessarily see. And I'm not
Let me just give, maybe it's to the generation of persons in my generation, I'm 86 going on 87, God willing, in January next year. One of the great gospel songwriters, Reverend James Cleveland, wrote a gospel song, and one of the lyrics in that song said, nobody told me the road would be easy, but Lord, I don't believe you brought me this far just to leave me. You understand what I'm saying?
I do.
So, you know, I believe. Well, I woke up this morning with my mind set on freedom. You understand? And I'm part of that generation that believes that. There are some people who might say, well, you know, Dr. Jones did this, and Dr. Jones did that. I said, listen, my parents live in domestic household servants, you know, and I was an only child. Now, I have to believe that what they enabled me to do by putting me in being raised by white Irish Catholic nuns in a Catholic boarding school, and the things that happened along the journey of my life, and the modest successes, academic and otherwise, that I've been able to achieve, I'd be a damn fool if I thought that was solely only because of, Clarence Jones is so great, he did this. I said, no. I am forever, ever indebted to my parents and people who helped me along the way. And I'm not trying to preach to anybody. I'm simply saying, I woke up this morning, and I know why I woke up this morning. Yes, because I have had some health issues along the way. But there is, in my belief, there is a God looking out for me. That's the only way I can explain it. Otherwise, I wouldn't be alive.
It is something else that struck me. Again, just observations. A few weeks ago, and it was only 1 week, when Scaramucci was put as communications director in the White House.
Right.
It was really the first time in the Trump presidency this struck me, but it made me think. Because I always tend to believe that people, no matter what their political affiliation, in the end, know what is right and what is wrong, not
right.
What is politically expedient.
Right.
Now, when Anthony Scaramucci gave this interview, where he used some of the foulest language that you could use. Not that people don't use foul.
No, I understand.
Yeah. When he did that, I saw people of the church, good-natured people who would never use that word, that language in mixed company, defend it for no other reason than he's a Trump guy. And that's,
well, that's just morally obscene. That's ridiculous. I mean, there's no question about that. You know, in the feudal times and used to times, kings used to have court jesters. You know, kings would have court jesters come out. I mean, Scaramucci was like an obscene court jester that came out, to try to defend this president and say certain things. I mean, please, let's not lose our moral compass. I mean, there is no basis whatsoever, none whatsoever, for anybody that has any standard of what is there not some general consensus as to what is called common decency? Is there not some general census of right and wrong? I'm not saying that I'm Mr. Goody Two Shoes, or I'm not saying that everybody has to be religious, carrying around some banner of righteousness. But there is in a society a standard of elementary common decency. There's a doctrine in the law called judicial notice. You know, the judicial notice, where the court will excuse a party having to prove that the sun rises in the east and sets in the sun. You don't have to bring a lot of geographical. The court judicially notices this and accepts that. So I'm hoping that there is some common sense of morality and decency. It doesn't matter whether you're Muslim, it doesn't matter what religion it is, there's some standard that some consensus that everybody can, you can just look at it and say, that's wrong on its face. You know, a Supreme Court justice, oh God, I think I can't remember the justice who said it, I said, must be getting old, who said, you know, you recognize pornography when you see it. You know, you don't have to try to write a legal definition of what it is. So you recognize obscenity when you see and hear it. One doesn't have to. And so for anyone, religious or otherwise, to justify or rationalize some of that garbage, filthy language of Scaramucci, there is no justification for it. There is none. Zero. Zero.
Well, and I think here's one of the issues. When I go back and look at election night, we've had elections many, many years in this country, and you look at Hillary's Javits Center, where all her people were, when it started to look like she was not going to win, people were sobbing, men and women. Now, I don't buy into the idea that it was because Hillary Clinton lost or because we weren't going to have the first woman yet. I think it's that rhetoric, for good or for bad, because the Trump supporters who voted for him, I don't know how they see it. But when he would go on television and say things like, we're going to build the wall, and I don't know who the leader of the Ku Klux Klan is, I don't know who David Duke is, I didn't hear the question just right. And when he said things about women that he said, I think that's why they were crying. I think they thought, this is not us. I mean, people lose elections all the time. I never saw emotion like that.
Well, I think that, yeah, I think you're right. I think that the mean inflation at that time is that the country would choose a candidate who had said and done all of those things that you described, particularly like within 30 days, I think, this video about how he would was how he would talk to and treated beauty contestants. How he could, he just treated and regarded and talked to women like they were mere sex objects with total. So I understand that. And I mean, when I say I understand, I don't imply in any way that I agree with it. But I mean, I understand the shock. Different than what you describe. I mean, I understand the pain and shock to the people who work so passionately for Hillary, that I understand that. But my difference is, I wasn't shocked that he won. I was surprised, because I thought it was could very well be possible. I was not as shocked as most people were. I said, well, this is what I thought could happen, but I was not shocked at all. I was shocked by the conduct of the candidate, and I think the real problem we're going to face is that I think there probably will be evidence that shows that the Russians interfered in the elections, probably interfered against Hillary. That may be established. The fact that they interfered, however, is separate from the fact as to whether the Trump organization, the presidential campaign, actively, directly, or indirectly colluded with the Russians. I think that it's likely to be found that while Trump and the campaign welcomed everything that could be done to undermine Hillary Clinton's campaign by the Russians, I think that there could be a finding that, yes, the Russians did interfere with the election, but there's no evidence that Donald Trump colluded with them to win. The problem is that, and this is beyond the scope of the time we have, the reason why I was not surprised is because I began to see, as I traveled and listened and read different papers from different parts of the country, that the Democratic leadership, the Democratic Party and the leadership of Hillary Clinton had become or was becoming irrelevant to the issue that most voters were concerned about when they were going to the polls. And that that her own credibility had been undermined both by her own actions and by the suspicions raised by the letter talked about by James Comey and the FBI, that her own credibility, notwithstanding very attractive elements of the Democratic Party platform, and her own misstatements, I mean, to call Trump supporters deplorables. I mean, that's like shooting yourself in the foot, you know. And regret. And from my standpoint, I believe that the current leadership of the Democratic Party is still irrelevant to the issues that I perceive that most people are dealing with. And this is very sadness, and I've supported Democrats and worked for Democrats all my life, and I just say, it's like they're on some other planet. I don't know. Clearly, the Democratic Party is a party of the East Coast and the West Coast, and they forgot about everybody in the middle.
It has flipped. In the last 9 minutes we have, I do want to talk about the Russia thing a little bit, because something
right.
that disturbed me. And obviously it led up to the Manafort raid on July 26th. But something that disturbed me last week is after the election, I remember in the newspaper the day after Trump wins, and way in the back of the newspaper there was a little story about the Russians celebrating it and that a Russian said he had met with somebody from the Trump campaign. Seemed like a throwaway story. Now we go to last week. And last week we learned that on the day of the election, there were officials from the CIA and FBI holed up in an office to make sure that Russians did not tamper with voting machines, which could have changed everything. Now, it seems like the more we dig into this, the more we find out. Now, they have went into Manafort's house. It took, they had to go to a magistrate to get that warrant. If they even find an email or a paper where somebody from the Trump campaign, not Trump himself, said, can you tamper with voting machines? We plan to tamper with voting machines. That's going to throw...
Oh, yeah, that's... Well, you know, I mean, I'm not going to... You have to follow... You have to have your opinion follow the evidence, you know. If you're making a... If you make a hypothetical assumption that a certain set of facts are uncovered, then there are certain conclusions that can come from those hypothetical facts that you assume will be uncovered. So clearly, if that occurs, then that even changes what I said earlier. I say my position currently is in the absence of evidence to the contrary. I think they will show that there was efforts on the part of Russia to interfere in the election. But I'm saying, in the absence of there being any collusion between the Trump campaign and those efforts, I think the whole thing's going to collapse.
That being said, what do you make of the raid on Manafort's house, the way they did it, strictly from a legal perspective?
Well, I think you asked me, I'll answer the question as you asked it. Strictly from a legal perspective, I think they had reasons which neither of us know, we only anticipate. Maybe they had reasons, since this occurred, the raid occurred 2 days after they had actually met with Manafort. I think they had reason to believe that if they didn't move quickly, there might be evidence that they suspected he might have or be in his possession or have access to that could be removed or made impossible for them to get. And so they wanted to move quickly to ensure that that did not occur, to ensure that, in fact, if there was evidence, if there were things that they were suspicious about, and I suspect that they were suspicious about it even when Manafort came in and had conversations with them, even when they were conducting an interview with him, I think they knew at that time. This is my belief. I have no evidence whatsoever to support my belief. But I believe at that time they were thinking about or planning to go in to get a warrant to search his house. Or maybe, contrary to what I've just said, maybe it's a direct result of that interview with Manafort, in which while it is described that he was had been very forthcoming, that maybe he was not as forthcoming on issues that they thought were very important, and they felt that he had said enough, had disclosed enough to them to suggest that they better move quickly for fear they might not have access to evidence to confirm what they believe they need to prove.
And kind of a long ball to throw here in our last 4 minutes, but the nagging question for a long time has been, not that he needs to do it by law, the tax returns. Why haven't these been shown, and why is President Trump even so nervous as to say, I draw a red line if Mueller gets into my finances? What could be so bad?
Well, this is all hypothetical speculation on both of our parts. First of all, he might feel that just in terms of the limits of the mandate of Mueller's investigative authority, that to investigate his tax returns would simply be beyond that authority. Secondly, and I believe more importantly, that the reason that Donald Trump, one or more of the reasons that Donald Trump has not released his tax, I believe, are related to One is that when you do a forensic financial analysis of his tax returns, you will find that there is more smoke and mirrors than substance, and that his claimed wealth may be greatly exaggerated, or both. And this is what I think that he is most concerned about. And I have absolutely no, I've not read anything or heard anything to support what I'm about ready to say. So what I'm about ready to say is purely speculation. But I have followed the news, both in 60 Minutes and reading the financial press, that a number of the financing, the source of the monies that Trump organizations were able to achieve came through banks, particularly the Deutsche Bank and the German U.S. Bank, and a bank related to a bank in Cyprus that had as a large part of its deposit funds, a large part of its funds to make loans from powerful Russian oligarchs, and that the source of financing that Trump was able to access as a business person, that he was not able to access on a creditworthy basis from U.S. banks, he was able to get from banks were directly or funded from persons in Russia. So even if my first assumption is wrong, that in fact he is as wealthy as he says he is, but that my second assumption may be right, that the source of creating that wealth is because a great deal of it has been enabled or made possible by money coming directly from Russian sources, that is, sources in Russia, or Russia wealth that has come out of Russia and put in places like Deutsche Bank and other banks that have been favorable and friendly to financing Donald Trump in a way that he was not able to get financed by U.S. banks. And I think that that's what he's most concerned about.
A lot of assumptions in the world, but one thing that is not an assumption is that every time Clarence B. Jones comes on this program, I'm always thankful because we learned something, and I hope that we can do it again. It is always
a
pleasure.
Well, I'm very honored. I'm very honored that you would reach out to me, and as always, you know, I'm sure there'll be going to be some of the many listeners who agree with things that you say and agree with things that you and disagree with things you say. And I suspect it's not too different with me. There's some people who might otherwise have great respect for me over the years and might say, well, I can't believe I just heard Dr. Jones. And he's lost his mind. I heard him say this. Well, they're entitled to that opinion. But just know that my opinions come from an honest and careful, thoughtful reflection. And even those people who disagree with me, I still will always respect them and hope that I can continue and earn their respect.
Dr. Jones, always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye. Clarence B. Jones, longtime friend, attorney, and speechwriter for Martin Luther King Jr. Stay tuned. Lots more after this.
Conan O'Brien, Jim Fowler.
What is something you regret?